Artistic with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi and welcome to the 85th episode of Robots. I'm Yana, and this is the second of our three-part series on robot art. Today, David Sangdong, who compiled this series and works as an arts engineer himself, will be talking to two prominent figures at the interface of arts and robotics, Bill Vorn and Louis-Philippe Demers. They started their careers as colleagues creating many state-of-the-art robotic projects, such as La Cour des Miracles. But first, let's hear the latest news and developments in robotics from Christine.
Thank you. Researchers at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia have created a robotic golf trainer to help you putt. It consists of a 150x70cm green base with practice holes and a practice putter. Four ropes attach the putter to the base plate's corners. When swinging the putter, the rope tension is automatically adjusted by electric motors, correcting any deviation. The result is that the golfer feels forces pulling them back to the correct position when they go wrong, making it feel natural to swing correctly. While similar techniques have long been used to help patients with movement disorders to retain their muscle memory, this is one of the first systems developed for recreational use. The researchers now plan to improve the system by reducing the friction in the wires so the altered swing feels more natural. In other news, industrial robot manufacturer ABB has converted one of its robots into a hotel baggage handler. It allows a hotel visitor to place their bag into a special tray. The robot arm on the other side of the glass front then picks up the tray and turns around to store the tray in a specific drawer. The fancy luggage check room belongs to hotel series Yotel, founded by British entrepreneur Simon Rudroff, and is found in London, New York, and Amsterdam. Apart from its obvious use, the robot arm also serves as a decorative element, underlining the futurism of the hotel brand. For more information on the robotic golf trainer and the robotic hotel baggage handler, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
Bill Vorn is Associate Professor at the Department of Studio Art at the University Concordia in Montreal, Canada. His research explores artificial life and aging technologies through artistic work based on the aesthetics of artificial behaviors, and he is now responsible for the A-Lab, a robotic art research creation lab, which is part of the Hexagram Institute.
Welcome, Mr. Vorn. So I know that you start your art career more in the music field. I'm interested how you translate from music to robots, how it happens and why.
Well, it started a long time ago, and in fact it doesn't translate right away. Yes, I was a musician and I was a composer for many years, doing making music in a band and doing music for film and advertisement and so on. But I also started studies in communication. So I got interested in using a lot of different media, like video and sound and new media, because at the time, the computer was getting accessible. So it's really this idea of touching not only one thing but many different mediums, different ways of expressing things. And in 1992 I met Louis-Philippe Demers, with whom I worked for many years afterwards, and we started to work with robotics because we were looking for a way to animate sound and light in space And because Louis Philippe was coming more from the theater side, you know, like he was used to working with lighting, and he was also a programmer. And of course, I was coming more from the sound aspect. And so together, we just sort of had this idea of using mechanism to make speakers and light sources move. And yeah, that's how we came up with this first project called Vector Space.
This was a theatrical performance?
No, it was not a performance. It was an installation.
Oh, okay.
So it was an interactive robotic installation where we had those sort of moving tubes projecting sound and light and following the viewers in the room. Because we also started to work with ultrasound sensors to detect the presence and the movement of viewers in the space.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me one of the first performance you made. I'm not sure what was the name, but it was a theatrical performance with a lot of machine on stage, and huge machine were on the stage with a set of actors. Could you tell us a little bit on the conception of this performance and how you managed to make a scenario involving machines and humans to make repetitive performances?
I think you're referring to a piece called Le Procès.
Exactly.
This one started it was sort of part of a bigger project by Robert Lepage, who's a famous theater director from Quebec. And he had this idea of making this technological cabaret where he was inviting different artists to do different numbers in the cabaret. And Louis Philippe and I were one of these numbers, and we decided to make something like was, you know, where there were no human actors, they were just like machines on stage. So we developed this idea for this theater show, but at the same time, you know, it was kind of like we were free to do whatever we wanted, like we had carte blanche to work on whatever kind of project. But this project changed a little bit with time, and you know, it was not a cabaret anymore, and Robert Lepage decided to make a more like a real theatrical play. But it didn't really work, because first it was very complex technically, and I think the reviews were not that good. So what we decided to do is simply to take our number out of this theater play, and it became our own performance at the time. And then,
but you kept it still as a performance, or you transformed it?
Yeah, but then it was not a performance inside a theater play. Mm-hmm. It was just a standalone robotic performance.
And so in the last versions, there were machines and humans? Or only machines were performing?
No, they were only machines.
Only machines?
Well, the humans were the controllers, like people were turning on the show.
Running the machines, actually. And what kind of machine were you using in this performance?
Well, we had different things. Like, we had one machine that was built on a Stewart platform. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was a pair of machines. We had a lot of suspended machines, because we try to use that as much as we can, because there's a lot less wear on the machines when they're suspended, and rather than when they're walking on the floor.
And how you managed to develop each of those machines? I mean, in the conception approach, how did you decide to build this one and this one and this one? What was the casting, or how did you make the casting for this show?
Well, on most of the different productions that I work on, there's always sort of a main theme, sort of a something that guides you when you work on to develop those robots. In the case of Le Procès, because in English it's the trial, so obviously there were judges and other characters that were sort of involved, But there was no like direct relationship with, let's say, the trial from Kafka, or but it was just loosely inspired by this. Exactly like in La Cour des Miracles, which is an installation we did maybe a few years before the trial. And in the La Cour des Miracles, like the main theme was the misery of the machine. So we tried to develop machines that can sort of express this idea that, you know, they have a little bit of trouble surviving life.
Mm-hmm. In each of your either performance or installation, you're developing yourself, actually, the robots in your studio where we are meeting right now. Can you explain us what's the technical process you're going through when you're developing a robot? So you spoke a little bit about the conception or how you're making the casting for the show, but then when you're having the idea, how you make it to the materials, and what's the process to get the final product of your robot?
I would say there's a lot of trial and error. I'm not really an engineer, so I don't develop things like using CAD software and working on the virtual aspect before the real thing. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I'm not a sculptor, so I'm not really using a hammer, and mm-hmm. so somewhere in the middle where I assemble things. If you look at what I do, it's all bolted part, metal parts, standard dimension parts, and so it's kind of more or less easy to assemble and disassemble. So you can try different things, and but it's there in front of you, so you can really see if it works or not in the real life, mm-hmm. which is not always the case with with CAD, because sometimes you have surprises when it comes into reality. Okay.
Mm-hmm. You take into account that the CAD will represent well the reality, and then you're having some surprise.
But for me, it's really important to see what the machine is doing, okay? Because sometimes it's not exactly doing what you wanted it to do at the beginning, but what it is doing is in fact quite interesting, mm-hmm. Even if it's kind of clumsy, or if it's
it may fit better actually what you the concept. Mm-hmm.
For example, in La Cour des Miracles, we had this machine called the limping machine, so it was supposed to walk and of course have problems to walk, but the machine was never able to walk at all, so we just flipped it on its back and it looked more despaired, it looked more sort of helpless being on its back than whatever else, so we really achieved this idea of having a miserable machine, even if it was not doing what we wanted to do at the first place. So mm-hmm. just by playing with it, just by having it there and playing with it. Mm. So that's more or less how I work in the studio. Mm.
And you're working the same way with the actuators, the motors, you're just trying them, plugging them with the structure and looking how it reacts and if it's powerful enough or too powerful, and by trial and error also?
Well, sometimes you still have to, you don't want to buy 10 different motors to try, mm-hmm. but there are things that are just tested in real life, but others that are more planified.
Mm-hmm. What I found really interesting, part of what I found really interesting in your particular work is that sound is always really important in each of your installations, sound and music. How you manage to, what's the importance of sound when you're building a robot, and how you manage to make some robots and some actuators do the sound that you want, or create a sound ambience that you're searching for?
Well, I think it's just one more way to give a personality to the machine, because you give the machine different possible expressions. So you create a palette of, it's just like creating a more complex ontology. Different things that the machine can do more than if it didn't have this medium. Mm-hmm. This is important for the machine itself, but there's also like a general soundtrack for the entire piece. Like the, so sound is there to immerse the viewers, to create this make-believe about this more or less futuristic artificial world where the machines are living. So it helps create this displacement, but at the same time there are some very specific sound assigned to those machines, and this are
some machine are having speaker embedded on, yeah, on exactly. the structure that are playing sound also that are pre-recorded sound or generated sound or both, depending on the
well usually it's all you know, it's sort of a pre-established bank of samples, but those sounds are coming from processed organic and industrial sounds, and so you cannot really recognize the source, but at the same time it gives a very sort of like that's something that you can it give, you know it gives you this evocation of something else. So sometimes it will sound a bit like an animal or even somebody crying, or so it's really about expression. It's really about trying to find some sort of, you know, a machine can do more than just buzzes or you know, bleeps or you know, like.
In your artwork, are you searching to provoke the visitor or to provoke a reaction to the visitor? And are you listening to the reaction to the feedback of the visitor when they're going to your installation? Are you concerned by this perception?
Well, I think I'm looking more to provoke the imagination of the viewers, because yes, I'm interested in all those different interpretations that people will have in front of the piece, and yes, I'm interested in what they think of it. When they get out of the room and they you know, start commenting on what they've seen, because everybody has seen something different. And that's the idea. Okay, I work with very abstract shapes and forms, and it's totally non-representational. It's not about imitating anything. It's just about creating life from a bunch of moving metal parts. So that's really what I want to do. So if people see animals or humans or in these totally abstract things, then I think I've achieved what I wanted to do. And of course, if they can see more than that, then it's even better. Like for example, I saw people crying when they saw La Cour des Miracles, because they were really touched about all this misery expressed by the robots.
Wow.
But of course there's no misery at all. No, it's just a show. It's just
and it's just mechanics also. It's their own perception of it. And it makes me think of another of your artwork named The Hysterical Machine, that I found really hysterical, completely hysterical. It's really almost chaotic when you're getting near this installation. You're having the huge, you're having different size, I guess, of those hysterical machines, and they're really getting completely hysterical when you're approaching them and excited. Or I guess all the visitor must be quite must agree on this theme of being hysterical. Could you describe us a little bit why you decide to do this installation, where the idea came from about
the thing is,
being hysterical?
Yeah, the thing is they're not that hysterical, because if they would really be hysterical as they can be, the show would last for 2 minutes and then they would be completely destroyed, because they have the potential of being very
destroy themselves,
very expressive. So for me, it's sort of a kind of quiet show. Even if people think that's aggressive or violent, but it's not that bad at all, because anybody can be touched by an arm of the robot, and they will be surprised, but they won't be hurt. But the idea behind that was really to work about from the behavior of the machine, what the machine expresses. In this case, the machine was expressing some kind of aggressivity or or violence, and I called them hysterical because, you know, they had this sort of change of mood or a change of, you know, range from being sort of more or less quiet to very energetic. Mm-hmm. So, and also because they react to the presence of people, like how many people are around, or
mm-hmm. how, the more people how there close, is, the more hysterical they're getting, I guess.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And so actually in this case, you start from building a machine, and then you looked at what kind of emotion it creates, or what kind of behavior it creates, yeah. from
well,
its mechanics.
Sometimes it works this way. Sometimes, like, you build the shape, or you build the thing, and from there you decide that this machine will become or will express more this or this behavior. But sometimes you work in reverse. Sometimes you start from the behavior. In the case of the hysterical machines, I wanted to build something hysterical from the start. Mm-hmm. So this is why I give them so many arms, so it can really move in all different directions. And it gives also the machine a certain volume to have those arms, because like the hysterical machine has 8 arms. A bit like an octopus, but it's sort of like the arms can extend to about 2 meters, and so it creates a more aggressive thing than it is in reality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. By the visual impact it gives, and the sound and light, I guess, helps a lot in that.
But now there's a mega hysterical machine, which is 4 meters above.
Yeah, I heard about it. I haven't seen it yet. Yeah, 4 meters is quite huge. I guess it can be dangerous at this size if it gets too hysterical, isn't it?
Yeah, but I control the air pressure and
the level of hysteria.
It's a little bit quieter than the other ones.
Ah, okay. In your career, you collaborate with a lot of people to do many different installations. You spoke about Louis-Philippe de Messe, that we interviewed also for this these podcasts. That you collaborate for the Gray State Machine, I guess, with a choreographer also. And I was wondering if you, well, I know you're building most of your robots yourself in this studio here, but have you ever collaborate with engineers or researcher in robotic fields to build your robots, or to inspire both researcher on each other fields?
I had collaborations with engineers from Sherbrooke University and from what we call ETS, which is a technology school in Montreal. But it was mostly like sort of a very technical collaboration on specific, very specific developments or very specific technologies. It was not really related about, you know, like very about characters of a piece or developing a robot for a show. It was more like
developing tools or gadgets,
yeah, or systems that are related to control. And,
mm-hmm. and was it something like that you asked them to develop for your needs, or that they asked you to use for their needs after having developing it, or?
It was more starting
was
from
it,
it was more starting from what they have developed, mm-hmm. and trying to integrate it in what I do. Mm-hmm. Like in the case of Sherbrooke University, the guys at Laborious, which is the robotics lab down there, I think now it's called Intro Lab. Sorry, mm-hmm. They developed this sound location system, which, you know, helps you tracking voice in a room, so you can detect from which angle it's coming from. Mm-hmm. So with this system, I'm able to control like an industrial robot arm and have it follow the movement of people in the room. Of course, they have to talk or to emit some sound. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's one application that we have done with it.
Mm-hmm. So they came to you to find application from some of the hardware they developed, or while they were making the conception of it also, they were having discussion with you about what could it be more useful for you?
Well, in this case, that was something that they were always already working on since a few years.
Okay.
It was already developed to a certain stage. But then for our needs, it was like sort of transformed into something else.
Extended to your needs. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the other collaboration you were speaking about at Technological School?
Well, it was more or less a more loose collaboration where like we in fact wanted to see if there were collaboration possible. So they came here and I went to their lab and we exchanged some ideas. And also because the professor there was really into parallel mechanisms. Mm-hmm. So he helped me working on like some of my robots for the red light piece.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But no, it was really sort of informal,
like consulting service, or that you were giving in an informal way.
Because in general, I'm not working like an engineer, so it's really difficult to sort of establish a good collaboration between myself and the scientific. Because in fact, what I'm trying to do is to try to subvert what they're doing. Okay? Mm-hmm. It's a bit like using a like the Stewart platform and piling four of them onto each other.
Mm-hmm. Like in the gray state machine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because usually they don't understand why you do that.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
But sometimes when they see the show, then they
understand.
They have a better idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But when you just talk about it like this, yeah,
mm-hmm.
it's a bit vague and not obvious.
Mm-hmm. The situation here in this building where we are right now is also a little bit exceptional, well, at least for what I know, because you're having the Department of Computer Science and Engineering sharing the space with the Department of Fine Arts in which you're working. So I know that between the professor, I guess there is like some discussion that it leads to just because you're sharing an environment, at least when you're opening your labs to visitors and things like that. But do you think there is any impact on the students that are studying here, the fact that those two departments are physically close in the one to the other?
Well, it's true that we're both in the same building, but we're kind of two solitudes. Like it's, you know, like, even if there's no brick wall or doors in between the two faculties, you know, there's still the engineering and computer science world on one side and the arts world on the other side. Yes, there are some links and collaborations, but they're very few. And I would say that, especially for the students, they don't mix up that much.
Mm-hmm.
There are some joint programs. For example, there's a computation art double major that you can do in both arts and science.
Taking class in computer science and in fine
but
arts.
That's for a very small number of students. That's not for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
In general, people are still when they're in art, they're doing art. And even if they're using technology, they will still. So they don't mix that much.
Mm-hmm. I guess in your class that you're giving in electronic arts, you're speaking a little bit about robotic arts also. How do you teach students to do robotic arts? Is it something that you can teach actually to do robotic arts? And how do you tell them how to develop an artwork involving robotics?
Well, it's very open. No, it's not about making a robot, like making a humanoid robot with arms and legs, or even a lab robot with wheels. No, it's not about that. It's really about building a cybernetic system, something that can detect what's going on in the environment and have some ways of responding either with sound or light or video or whatever to this environment. So this is mostly how I teach the students, because they're not all interested into kinetic sculpture or moving robots, or they're more interested in the moving image or in sound, or sometimes they want to do everything, so I have to live with it. And so I get tons of different projects with, you know, like going in 10 different directions, but I have to sort of shoot in the middle and try to find like how I can get all these different people understanding at least, you know, the very basic of all the. So what I do usually is that I show them 100 different tools and they select what they want among that that can fit their project. So what I do is always project based. I let them do what they want to do, what develop what they want to achieve. And because for me, I think that's probably the best way for them to learn something. It's through have their own input into what they're doing. But you know, it's, I guess it's normal in a in an art school that it it works like that.
Well, thank you, Professor Vorn, for your time and to kindly answer all of my questions.
Louis-Philippe Demers is Associate Professor at the School of Art, Design and Media at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. In his work, he focuses on entertainment robotics, and he's won a number of prizes for his projects at the Ars Electronica, as well as the Heltman Award in Australia.
Welcome, Louis-Philippe Demers. It's a pleasure for us to receive you for this robot podcast. To introduce your work, you're now a full professor in the School of Art, Design and Media in Nanyang Technology University in Singapore, and you're also a well-known artist in the robotic art field. Could you tell us how you came to work with robots in your artworks?
Let's say the original path of starting doing robotic art probably had anything to do with motion. That was back, like, I think in early 90s. At that time, I was involved in theater, or let's say stage production, all kinds of either opera or like modern dance and so forth. I was doing mostly like scenery and lighting environments and so forth. And then at that time, I met a guy in Montreal, which is also a known artist in robotic, like Bill Vorn. And Bill at that time was making a lot of music for films and jingle. He used to have a technopop band and so forth. So we were both interested in putting, let's say, light and sound in motion. And we were also interested in creating an environment where we would be like kind of the directors of this kind of environment. So probably getting rid of performers or getting rid of contexts that are related to humans. So because we wanted to explore something that was maybe out of the realm of having human performers or like that kind of connotation. So basically like sat down and said like, oh, maybe we can use robots to do this. So like we just, you know, just started like this without, let's say, any without any idea where it's going to lead us as well, without any, like, let's say, formal background or training, though I had a bit of background in robotics, but it was mostly software. So that's, let's say, how it started. Then it developed through like several phases. I think at the beginning we were mostly interested in robotics as like ecological systems, so like robots together, what they represent and so forth. So they were using light and sound as some kind of invented metabolism. So that was about for 4 or 5 years. Then we shifted more and more into like more human social metaphors without being directly related to, let's say, humans. So we made works about robot misery and things like this. So all kinds of things that will generate empathy towards the behaviors of the robot. And then a bit later, like, I shifted more towards performance, so challenging the fact that you can actually bring a robot on the stage where this is, let's say, normally like a place where mostly human performs and you know, what's a robot story for a human? So it's pretty hard to make to have a concept about these things.
Speaking about your first work, could you describe us quickly the work La Cour des Miracles?
This is actually 98. I think that's about the fifth work I did with Bill. La Cour des Miracles was it's actually like the title is coming from Victor Hugo, and it's in it's actually in a real place. It's in Paris. This is an area where, you know, basically like all poor people, people who had problem will like just gather together, like your typical ghetto and stuff like this. So this, like, we started from his description of this and created an environment where we're talking about robot misery. So just how to embed or how to implement metaphors or analogies and behaviors in robot that people will trigger some form of empathy. Though, like, these, everybody knows that this is a total simulacrum, so that this is this was a bit of a challenge. It's actually quite surprising that it's working quite well, that people have actually a lot of pity when they look at a robot that has convulsion on the floor and so forth. So they are like really like large immersive environment. Like, we, in the biggest version, and I don't know how many robots in there, but more than 20. I mean, there were main characters, and the rest was mostly like robots, just to oversaturate your senses. So you kind of feel that there's always something happening in the periphery of your eye. So you don't really, your attention spent towards a robot shifts constantly because everything is moving around you. So you're a bit, disconcerned by everything that's happening around you. So you don't start deconstructing one machine. And if you look at it and look at its behavior, there's simply too many things that happen that your senses are overloaded. So it just, the intellectual part happens like as soon as you're out of the space.
For each of your artwork, I guess, you're developing the robots and you're making the conception of the robots in different ways. But what would be the general pattern you're using to make the conception of the machines you're going to use?
Let's say, like, pattern usually starts with the, let's say, concept or the environment or the metaphor. Like, let's say, I'm going to do a piece about robot misery. I'm going to do a piece about, like, the role of communication in ecosystems and so forth. So, like, then this is the first step. And then right after, we just jump into, let's say, when we build the machines, we start with the behavior. And let's say establish, like, okay, this machine is going to do this, this is going to do this, and so forth. And then we build a shape or morphology that fits the behavior. So, like, we never really start from rarely start from an existing robot and try to put the behavior on a morphology. It's morphology always follows the function, which is it's a strategy, but it's kind of integrated a bit better for us. In terms of, like, being able to implement the function. So this is probably why as well there's no humanoids in most of the work. There might be, there might be things that resemble humans, but you know, you probably have to extrapolate quite a lot. But having heads and limbs and so forth, it's quite easy to anthropomorphize this. But beyond this, they're not like carbon copies. So if a machine is made to perform some function, you just develop something that kind of support that function, either mechanically or either as a metaphor. I mean, it doesn't mean necessarily that it becomes a tool, but it becomes like a vector to implement the behavior.
So we spoke a little bit about one of your first work with Billhorn. Now you're doing different kind of works. Could you speak about one of your later work, maybe the Tyler Girls?
Yeah, the Tyler Girls. It's actually like a piece that deals a lot about, what are the qualities of performers when they're on the stage. So the Tyler Girls is actually coming from a dance group, like from early century. Tyler was actually somebody who had like a manufacturer, like I think a clothing manufacturer, and a lot of employees were dancing in his group. And Tyler was not interested in the personal interpretive skills of each dancer, but was only interested in the overall group effect. So like this is why you have these high kicking movements, and they make patterns, and they all like in a row, and they move along. There's a lot of dynamic things happening in there as well. As the important and the link is always the last dancer. It's never the one in the middle. The one in the middle are kind of caught in the flow. So there's actually a lot of interesting aspects of dynamics happening in there. But at the same time, like they use this in performance theory, that Tyler Gross all the time. They try to compare like what could be like a machinic performance as opposed to a human performance, like because we think that humans, like, you know, we supposedly have emotions and all kinds of stuff like this, and machines are just basically mechanical and repeating mm-hmm. tasks that have been programmed. Mm-hmm. So there was this, and at the same time I was collaborating with the AI lab in Zurich with Professor Pfeiffer, and then I saw some of these robots that they were actually building to study gaits and all kinds of locomotion from very, very minimal, capabilities of the robot. And of course, like, they're studying embodiment, and they're looking at, minimal contribution of intelligence into, like, generating behavior. So I found this quite interesting as, like, a pending to, it's almost like a reverse situation of what's happening in the real Tyler Grove. So I said, okay, that would be quite an interesting clash to put this mm-hmm. together. This is one part with the AI lab in Zurich, but the other part is to actually take a scientific experiment, which is, you know, when they do this, they put this in the lab and they look at it, and just to augment it and put a context around it and see what gets reformulated in terms of perception from the audience. Because if you would look at a robot, these little robot in a lab, like you will probably totally only deconstruct the movement and just like say, okay, this is working like this, and this is a good response to this. This is behaving this way. But if you put it out of context, your grid of analysis totally changes. It's only by moment that people go back maybe to the more scientific experiments. So it's just somehow like try to see like how much of a artistic context or a change of context, let's say, from the lab changes everything. Because of course, like, people are doing robot, normally they're made to be out in the world, not necessarily in the lab. So mm-hmm. it's just to see how much the environment at large changes either the perception or even the behavior. Because if the perception is changed, the behavior is changed, even if the behavior is the same. So that's a bit the idea of the point, that maybe scientific world are forgetting that you cannot look only at one part of your scientific result. You have to put it in the context of the whole environment.
Mm-hmm. You have to put it into the field. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you put it in the field, but environment is, especially like when people start dealing with social robotics and, you know, robotics that interact with humans in all kinds of ways, their capacities, their capabilities of doing things is altered by the reception from the viewer. So even if you had like a virtuoso robot that does something that has some cognition and blah, 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 so at the end, like, it's the end result is always the perception that you have of the robot. There's nothing else in there. Mm-hmm. So this is a very important factor that I think a lot of people are, not looking at, because it's actually really hard to have like scientific, hard scientific results about these things. They're called mm-hmm. intangible.
And you were speaking about your collaboration with the AI lab in Zurich. Mm-hmm. Did you have any other collaboration with a research scientist or engineer as this one? And in general, how did you manage these collaborations? So were you the first to go toward them? And how did you introduce yourself or explain them the work that you were doing?
In the AI Lab Zurich, it's a very specific context because I'm actually doing my PhD in the School of Design and Art in Zurich. So okay. They had a relation with the AI Lab Zurich. So I'm the one who went and knocked at their door and look what they were doing and, you know, just talking about all the process of building robots and looking at morphologies and see what are the resemblance between and the differences between, let's say, artistic process of making robots, and especially what they're doing at the AI Lab Zurich, which is, let's say, very, like, I won't say fundamental, but, you know, they try to bootstrap from the bottom, bottom-up approach to get into robots, so which is very close to
your own approach,
the process of what I'm doing. Otherwise, like, the let's say, in general, like, it's you have probably to find a common project or something that happens and by chance somehow, or like just happen by, you know, like discussing with other labs, but this didn't happen so much. I mean, the only time I collaborated as well was early beginnings. I was because I was doing my PhD in robotics in McGill. I didn't complete it. I left for art school. I was working with Vincent Hayward at that time. I think he's in Paris now. And so when I was starting building the robots, I would come and see him here and there and like get his feedback about more like, let's say, the technical aspect of the development of these things and maybe a bit about philosophy. But this was more ad hoc. But let's say, like, besides the AI Lab Zurich, which is the most concrete result, it's been sparse. There would be a project I'll be involved next year, which is actually combining. It's happening in Switzerland, so it's going to be between EPFL, ZADK in Zurich, and Theater La Manufacture, I think, from Lausanne. So, like, they all do something that revolves about technology on the stage. So, but this is next year, so I'll see how this goes at that point.
What do you think is or could be an advantage for a robotic lab of research to have such collaboration with artists, being ad hoc or being permanent, such collaboration as you had with the AR lab, for example?
There are like many advantages. I think, first of all, we probably look at it in a very different perspective. If you generate some scientific or engineering result, you're interested in analyzing your result and you get some metrics or whatever you needed to publish or get some conclusion about your work. What happened is like our grid of evaluation is very different, but yet complementary. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, an example that I could give is like probably in a lot of performance and even installation we've made, like we're probably able to achieve a lot of behaviors. Of course, they're very specific. They're non-generic. They kind of a character that you animate. And but nonetheless, the way we achieve it is done probably using technology, but probably not following any rules that you can analyze afterwards and say, okay, this has this, mm-hmm. has this, just in terms of technology. But at the same time, the results sometimes could be comparable to somebody who done this in a very systematically and so forth. So it'd be quite interesting to see what are we short-circuiting in the process that enables us to yet still achieve, a certain amount of behaviors without subscribing to something that is very, like, scientific or so forth. So I think the complementarities are quite important. And it's just like, I mean, using the word thinking out of the box, I mean, like, because we're outside of the box anyways. So it can give something. I'm not saying that it will give something. And of course, the end result is quite different if you look at arts or entertainment and things like this as a very different. We're not trying to make cars that can drive themselves. We're just, you know, probably artists.
Yeah, the objective is completely different.
Well, if artists would make cars that drive themselves, I think the first reflex would be to crash the car. So like very different because we're interested in accidents in the pure sense of it. So a lot of these things, because we can draw a lot of parallel in terms of what we can do intuitively. Because at the same time, like doing a robot is close to sculpture. It needs a lot of, let's say if you start as from the artistic process, since you don't necessarily have like huge teams or in-depth knowledge about a lot of these things, so you have like a very like some people would say naive, but on the other side I would say intuitive way of saying like, okay, this material bends well, this thing is elastic enough to implement this behavior. So we have all these things that we know by training about how to deal with materials, how to deal with context. So like there's all these things we do intuitively, is like would be quite interesting to see how you can make them, systematize them into like let's say a more scientific realm. So it'd be quite interesting to see how we can follow a very different path and probably achieve the same, I mean close to the same result. Of course, at the end we're not aiming at understanding human, or I mean in the same way science does. We just understand human from a different angle. So there's a lot of parallel. I mean, like even though if I would use like technologies like of like let's say recent artificial intelligence, like subsumption algorithms and all kinds of stuff, I mean at the end it's still like it's still not done in the same way, because we can short circuit a lot of things to. I mean, the end always justify the way you do it. So you can fake it. You can do all kinds of stuff to, which you should not do in science.
Yeah, the approach is completely different because the objective also is completely different. But I think there's a good inspiration, at least for the scientific community.
But I think at the end is like to maybe to look at the process and see like what's exactly happening there. Because when you start looking at, let's say, how you deal with materials and how we approach it, probably like in some cases, like you will build some equations or get something, and then you say, okay, we need something that bend with such coefficient and blah, 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 which as an artist, you're going to do it totally intuitively. You don't proceed by the same, but at the end, it will probably give the same results. So it's quite curious of what's happening there exactly.
So I think this will end our interview. I would like to thank you again a lot for taking this time to answer us. And I'm sure all the audience of Robot Podcast are really thankful to you for this time and for your answer. Thank you.
Yeah, same here. Thanks a lot. Thanks, David, for the question.
And that's the end of this episode. Next time, Lionel Mora and Ken Rinaldo will be talking about their work in the field of arts and engineering. If you'd like to find out more information about the projects or their creators, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Until then, goodbye. Be Artistic with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.